Hey everyone, this is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and I gotta tell you, I've got a very special bonus episode for you today with the one and only John Cleese of Monty Python's Flying Circus, of Fawlty Towers, of A Fish Called Wanda, of A Life of Brian, of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, of The Meaning of Life, and a million other shows and movies. Cleese has a career that spans 7 decades. This guy started performing publicly and hilariously in the 1960s. He has relentlessly satirized politics, religion, and everything else while stretching the boundaries of decorum and good taste like so many silly walks. Can you think of a person who has more bits that people can, you know, spout immediately from memory? I know stuff of his that it's been around for 50 years. He's a legend of legends. So Cleese is now 82 years old. And I want to point out, he studied law at Cambridge University, where he met the other Pythons. This was back, I guess, in the late 50s and early 60s. And, you know, him studying law is important for the first bit. That'll become clear in a couple minutes when the interview starts. But more recently, instead of going gentle into that good night, he has recently set his sights on kind of criticizing political correctness and wokeism, which he says are the enemies not only of humor and comedy, but of creative thinking in all areas of human activity. I caught up with John Cleese at Freedom Fest, the annual July gathering of libertarians in Las Vegas. Cleese was the keynote speaker there to discuss not wokeism and political correctness per se, but creativity, which was also the subject of a great little 2020 book he wrote that's called Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. It's a quick and excellent read, summarizing a wide range of psychological research on the topic over the past couple of decades, and also, you know, hilariously and really kind of insightfully drawing from his own experiences. He says it's a myth that creativity is something you have to be born with. He argues, actually, that anyone can be creative. He contends also, and this is actually pretty generous and it's pretty inspiring, that you can teach creativity. He writes, you can teach people how to create circumstances in which they will become creative. It's a good book. His comments at Freedom Fest were great. He gave a talk on the attitudes and habits of mind that he believes are necessary for creativity to the 2,500 attendees at Freedom Fest. And right after that, on the main stage, I interviewed Cleese about the importance of freedom of thought and expression when it comes to being creative, why wokeism is the enemy of all that, and why creativity, and you know, this is important, why creativity itself is so important to progress and civilization. Here is The Reason Interview with John Cleese.
Thank you, John, for talking about creativity, but I guess my first question is, do you regret not becoming a lawyer?
Can I tell you my favorite lawyer?
No, this is my time.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, but no, please.
Yeah, wait, there's no laughs now.
Yeah, no. I am sometimes called the antidote to humor. So, what about Cambridge law? Cambridge, you were about to.
I was about to say that my favorite joke about lawyers is that the U.S. Postal Service a few years ago issued a commemorative series of stamps commemorating famous American lawyers, but they had to withdraw it within a couple of weeks because people couldn't figure out which side of the stamp to spit on. You heard that before.
That's great. I have your creativity book, A Short and Cheerful Guide. It's available for sale. I highly recommend it. It's like cocaine for the brain, you know? But why is creativity so important for a thriving society?
Well, I think the most natural impulse that people have, other than curiosity, is to figure out, well, couldn't we do this better? Mm-hmm. You know, whatever it is. And I think that's a pretty natural kind of response, but I'm afraid the educational system doesn't encourage it.
Right.
I mean, it's not as bad as Japan was, for example. I had a friend who studied it there, and he said that the Japanese educational system was specifically designed to stop people thinking for themselves.
No.
You know?
Do you, I mean, you obviously grew up in England at a certain time where the school system was famous for being rigid and domineering and whatnot. Has it changed? And I mean, America is often seen as a place, you know, people wear baggy pants and anything goes. We're not structured enough. Is that a better environment? Or can you talk a little bit about the specific scenes of creativity?
I think it's always a question of balance, isn't it? Because discipline is essential to any kind of learning and getting better. It's essential, but at the same time, if you have too much, then you have a Chinese or Japanese system, as I say, where people, they don't want anyone to be creative because they're frightened that they will lose control. Mm-hmm. So all I can tell you is I can only think of one example where my creativity was stifled. We had a very nice teacher called Jumpaji, and he taught me English, which seemed to me a bit redundant because I spoke it pretty fluently anyway. He asked us to write an essay on time. And I'd already realized it's a very hard thing to write about, you know? You look it up in the dictionary and it says duration. Then you look up duration and it says time. So I wrote the whole essay about the fact that I'd not had time to write the essay. Now, you giggle at that. It's not bad, is it, for 15?
Yeah.
But he said to me, please, this isn't a proper essay. You see? He didn't have a go at me. He wasn't nasty. He wasn't particularly critical. He says, no, we just don't do things this way. And that's how our creativity gets stifled. And I think it's creativity that kids do have at an early age.
Do you think that, there's a certain amount of structure that needs to be in place. Like you got to rebel against a fantastic system, right? So can you talk
about it? It was a good system, okay, Nick, but it wasn't
a notorious system.
Yeah, it was okay. It was pretty good. But I mean, I always thought that teachers didn't understand that they needed to explain things. For example, I learned lots about the Protestants and the Catholics and Cromwell and Charles I, but no teacher ever told me what was the difference between them. There was a sort of an assumption by adults that you'd know, but the adults had never told. So there were lots of faults in it. But what I think was beneficial that we learned to learn to work. Mm-hmm. But I'm being quite honest with you. When I said at 18, when I emerged from the English system, I thought that it had taught me willpower, and that is how to work hard at something that I wasn't the slightest bit interested in.
Yeah. And in your book on creativity, you argue that you can teach creativity, and that it's basically a skill that you can pick up.
Well, it's
right?
What I was talking about there. I don't think you can teach creativity, but you can teach people how to set themselves up where they have the greatest chance of their own creativity emerging.
Right, and yeah. part of that is being set apart, right? Like, I mean, creating a wall around you so that you have to contemplate the blank page.
Because when you are everyone who writes, and I primarily know writers rather than musicians, everyone who writes will tell you that an interruption probably costs you 10 minutes. There have been two research, one said 15, one said 23 minutes. But because you're building something up in your mind, where character's here, he has to do that, she's over there trying to stop him, this has happened, someone else has just come in, and then somebody comes in. There's a Python sketch about this and says, Mrs. Beethoven says, Ludwig, do you know where the sugar bowl is? And the whole thing collapses. So when they leave, you have to go back and recreate all this, because otherwise you can't go on. That's why they're so dangerous. What I used to hate was, I'm so old, but when I had a telephone but not an answering machine. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? Because
yeah.
You always, any time it rang, you thought this might be important,
yeah.
And it never was.
No. You famously, you talk a lot about, and you've written about collaborating, particularly with Graham Chapman, who is a kind of, he was the best collaborator and the worst collaborator.
Yes, that's right.
Can you talk a little bit about your experiences with him and also the role of having somebody to bounce ideas off of?
Well, when you start as a comedian or as a comic writer, the great fear is this funny? Because you don't know, you don't have enough experience. You think, well, I think it's funny, will anyone else? And the extraordinary thing about Chapman was that if he laughed, and I discovered the audience was going to laugh. So the biggest single problem was solved by this. He was the perfect litmus test. If what I said was funny and he laughed, we put it down. That was wonderful. But I was in the engine room driving it forward. And I think, in a way, Chapman was creative. But the trouble is, I was too critical and analytical. And he was so dreamy that he was always off the wall and saying ridiculous things. The combination of us worked well, because what some people forget about a team is you want lots of people with different skills, right, not lots with the same skill.
Talk a bit, in your creative experiences, the role of drugs and alcohol, which, you know, bedevils creative people, particularly comedians, musicians, writers. What, you know, Chapman obviously had a real problem with the bottle, but did that also fuel some of his genius as well? What about you? Do you use any performance enhancing drugs as a to
money? I think.
Okay. Very nice.
For some reason, I think it was coming to do with my father. I've never been addictive, except to very small things like food. Mm. And the awful thing about getting older is food tastes better. Mm. It's just wonderful. I eat nothing else now.
What is the role of...
You did ask about it, and I think there is an interesting answer here. You see, I think that a lot of creative people are more in touch with their unconscious, which is where their creativity is coming from. But if your threshold is a little more porous, it may be that unconscious stuff, the more Freudian kind, can come up. Maybe that's why the wonderful ideas can come up, but they have to come up with the stuff that would be better kept down.
Right.
So I think that's quite often why people... Yes, I think that's right. And I think the other thing is that creativity is all about getting out of a rut. You see, if you're under any kind of pressure, you will always resort to stereotypical thinking. Do you see what I mean? You'll go back. There was a Canadian psychoneurologist called Donald Bem, I think.
I think you're just making that up now, but please continue.
I'll get the name sooner or later if they'll wait. Let me just think. Donald Bem or something like that. And he said neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, if you create in thinking a neural pathway, then, and you do that a few more times, it becomes the pathway. Right. It's just like wiring it. And I think there's a very good parallel with this. Somebody once said it's a bit like hiring a little house in the summer for a holiday for a month. And you go into the house and you think, oh, this is great. You go to the back garden and the grass is this high, but there's a little shed over there. And you think, I wonder what's in the shed. So you make your way through. And you get to the shed, you know, oh, I didn't know that would be there. And then when you come back, you don't come back by a different path, do you? Because this is already easier. Mm-hmm. So you come back the same path. And whenever you go to the shed, you go by that path. Well, what else is in the grass? You see, you never get to explore it. So the question, how do you get out of the rut? How do you get out of the wiring and go get out of the rut and look around in the grass?
By the same time, in your work on creativity, you also talk about the need for expertise or knowledge, that once you've mastered a subject, that's when you really know how to play with it.
Yes, so that's right.
So it's, well, I mean, I again, say, it's a balance.
Einstein didn't didn't come up with relativity the year he finished studying maths at school. Mm-hmm. You've got to do this enormous amount of work in some businesses, you know. As a mathematician, I think this is terribly, they have a terribly short period when they're at their best. Am I right?
Yeah.
Somewhere about 26?
I believe it. Yeah, they peak early.
They peak incredibly early.
Unlike comedians and journalists. We just keep getting better and better.
Oh, much better. Yeah. Much better. Let's not bother with that one. Let's move on.
Okay. Let's talk about the enemies of creativity. You mentioned, you know, it's kind of the educational system in a broad way.
Yeah.
It doesn't facilitate it. Wokeism is an issue that you've talked about. Why does political correctness or wokeism, how does that stifle creativity?
Because it's the internal interruption that I was talking about. You think of an idea, and you immediately think, ooh, is that going to get me into trouble? Well, that person happened on last Thursday, got away with it. All that stuff, which immediately stops you being creative.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing that's wrong about it.
What percentage of your oeuvre do you think would be inadmissible or not
permitted now? Well, it changes unpredictably. I mean, in my day, there was an enormous explosion in England. I think it was 1962. When Kenneth Tynan, who was our best theatre critic, deliberately used the word fuck. Mm. And there was it was like nuclear.
After that, the deluge.
Yeah, and now I can say fuck, and people, one or two people might twitch. Most people aren't bothered by it at all. But that was the
forbidden word. I'm a little bit excited,
word.
I have to.
But, sorry, shut up. Put me off.
But then there are many other words.
Well, there's the N-word. Now, just consider this situation. If I actually pronounce the N-word today, which I'm not going to, relax.
Okay.
I'm going to, it's all right, it'll be okay, okay? But if I did, it would be in the papers tomorrow. Now, how useful is that? What I think the woke people, I think they miss something quite badly. The meaning of a word depends on its context. If I use sarcasm, then what I'm meaning is the opposite of the words I'm actually saying. And irony is like that.
Yeah.
If you don't get irony, you know, then if you take it seriously, you completely misunderstand the intention of the writer or speaker.
We seem to be, some people said after 9/11 that irony was dead, but it seems like it probably died, to the extent it died earlier in people who will say that's not funny, no matter what, because they focus on the words rather than the meaning or the
content. That's right. They focus on the words and it, what matters. So I actually talk about this in my stage act, but I say, if teasing is done with affection. I mean, just now I said, oh, shut up to you. Mm-hmm. But everybody
inside,
smiled
crying.
Because they knew it was done with affection.
Right.
And as a joke. If that was reported tomorrow in the Hollywood Reporter, that I'd said that to you without any giving of context, it would look as though I was being very rude and unpleasant. Hmm. You see what I mean? And my daughter was talking about this at 3 o'clock when we did a show at the Southwest Festival. And it was a love-in. I mean, I don't know when I've had so much fun on stage. We had a fellow who was Puerto Rican. We had someone who was African-American. We had someone who was Jewish. We had a Scot.
Oh, my God.
All the minorities.
They're letting anybody into South by Southwest.
And an old white Englishman, you know. And we were teasing each other and saying the most terrible things. And there was an atmosphere, not, I mean this seriously, not just of laughter, but almost of joy at the freedom of it.
Yeah.
And then the Hollywood Reporter went back and quoted a couple of lines without giving any context at all. And then there was about 2 weeks of criticism and everyone getting, I mean, why? What are they getting out of it? I mean, there are people sitting there, Nick, who are deliberately waiting for the thrill of being offended.
No. Do you think that is that actually growing as a broad
yes.
sentiment? And what is driving that?
I don't know. I think an awful lot of the things that are happening at the moment is that there's the thing that scares human beings more than anything else, I mean, other than someone coming at them with a knife,
yeah.
is change.
Yeah.
I've wrote a couple of books or helped a psychiatrist to write a number of books, and he told me about the stress chart, where various actuaries working for insurance companies have discovered enormous amount of research has gone into this because it's hugely important to know when people are going to die if you're doing life insurance. And they studied, well, I think losing your spouse, let's call that 100. And then there's losing your job, which is 80-something. And then it goes all the way down. Then you get to Christmas, which is 18, you know? Getting married is about 40, because although getting married seems to be a good thing, it's a huge change. Now, the most extraordinary thing was, if you have a reduction in the number of rows you have every month with your wife, that costs you 35 points. And if you have an increase in the number of rows that you have with your wife, that costs you 35 points.
You have explained my relationship with my ex-wife. Thank you. I spent a lot of years in therapy. And,
yeah. How many ex-wives, Nick?
I just have the one.
Really?
Yes.
You lucky.
So the rumors are all false.
Oh, I've got three.
And are you done, or are you
no,
just
I
getting,
got a nice
are you going
one
for Elizabeth
well,
Taylor?
I married Americans three times, so I learned my
All
lesson
right.
eventually.
Yes. Yeah, that's very good. Wokeism, though, is certainly not the only enemy of creativity. You know, so we talked about maybe teachers or an education system. You have talked about how kind of what sometimes are called the suits, or you know, the people, the money people, running entertainment industries or things like that. How do they inhibit creativity?
Because everything they want is the opposite of what the creative people want.
Hmm.
They want clarity. You know,
mm-hmm.
business people, by and large, are very stressed because they're trying to control everything, especially things that they can't really control. And if you talk to body workers, like therapists or like physiotherapists or...
Prostitutes.
I don't know. Oh, I should ask them.
Interesting.
Very interesting. I think they help a lot, actually.
Body workers with stress.
But if you go to chiropractors or osteopaths or any of these people, they will tell you that the hardest people to work on are business people.
Because they're tight.
Because they're trying to control the process, even when they're being massaged. Whereas the easiest people to work on are the creative people, because they're used to just letting things happen without trying to control them. You see, when you're playing with your imagination, you shouldn't be trying to control it.
Mm.
You're just seeing where it takes you, because there's no such thing as a mistake.
So, but then, I mean, you're not kind of Allen Ginsberg, first thought, best thought, right? You have that. Can you talk a little bit about how you go from, you know, getting things out there that you're talking about, and then how do you kind of revise it down into something
I did Fish Called Wanda, which is the best film I ever wrote,
mm-hmm.
I did. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
By the way, I mean, obviously your whole life is like this, but that movie came out in 1987. Yeah, and it's still getting a massive response. That must feel wonderful.
Yes. Yeah, it does. I mean, it is very, very nice when people say to me, thank you for making me laugh. It always makes me feel good.
Yeah.
Because laughter's good, you know? I'll tell you when I realized this. I was at the Sarajevo Film Festival, And they were talking about the period when there was they were under siege, you know, the Serbs up in the hills, because Sarajevo's in a valley. They were lobbing shells down, and they had snipers, telescopic, you know, shooting people crossing the street. And what they did was they found an underground garage, and they converted it into a cinema. And when it got dark, they would all go to this cinema and watch comedy films. A lot of Monty Python, they told me, but a lot of comedy films. And by the end, when they left the cinema, they felt better. Now, nothing had changed. Do you see what I mean? Nothing had changed, but they felt better. They could cope with it better. And that's when they told me that. I suddenly realized that laughter really helps us.
Yeah.
It takes us to a part of our mind where we're probably healthier than we are at any other time. And it's this thing about laughing at yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure that the wokes would ever laugh at themselves, no matter how hilarious they are.
What Monty Python originally ran from 1968 to
69 to 73 or 4, and then we started making movies.
Right, and we have some audience questions about the movies I want to ask you. But how was it received? Because that was a tough time for Britain, right? And so you were kind of Britain, not quite Sarajevo, but something like that. Did people appreciate it, how many people were outraged by it? Because you were making fun of everything great about
Britain. Some people, I mean, my mother didn't get it. And a lot of the BBC executives didn't get it. I'm not kidding you. There was a meeting after four or five of the shows had been transmitted. Yeah. There was a meeting of the heads of department, head of drama, head of news, head of documentaries. They all had a meeting, about nine of them. And I think I'm right in saying six or seven of them basically said this Python thing isn't any good and we should cancel it. So three quarters of the top program makers in England thought that it should be discontinued. Now, I've been up against that all my life because the people in charge don't know what they're doing. But this is much more important. They have no idea what they're doing, but they have no idea that they have no idea what they're doing. Yeah. And that's the dangerous bit.
Yeah. In your creativity book, you quote William Goldman, the screenwriter, who among many, he wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men, among many, many.
And the one he was most proud of was Princess Bride.
Right. Yeah, which was based on his own novel. And but he's famous for saying in Hollywood, nobody knows anything.
That's right.
But they all act as if they do.
Well, that's right. And that was, I think that was 1980s he wrote that. But I now have a speech which is called Why There Is No Hope. Because when I was writing with this therapist, I got to know him very well, and I said to him, how many people in your profession really know what they're doing? And he said, about 10%.
Wow.
And after that, because I was so intrigued by that, every time I met someone who I suspected was particularly good, I would say to them, how many people in your... The highest I ever got was 20%.
Yeah.
Mostly it was 10 to 15, one or two people went as low as 5. Mm. But that means that 10 out of 15% of the people know what they're doing, and 85% don't.
Right.
But why don't the 85% get better? Because they don't know they need to. They think they're good already. Do you see what I mean? And if you think you're good enough already, you're not learning.
Right. You talk about overconfidence being another enemy of creativity.
Oh, terrible. I mean, when people know things for sure, there's very few things I know for sure.
This sounds like did you encounter Friedrich Hayek's work at all at Cambridge, the economist?
He was an economist.
Yes, so you steered clear of economists.
It was described as the dismal science when I was there.
I see, okay. And it remains, but he had a similar pretense to knowledge. Well, let me ask you a couple of audience questions. These were culled from thousands.
Yeah,
so these are the best of the bunch. The first one is, was the parrot dead, resting, or pining for the fjords?
Definitely deceased.
Okay.
He was no more. He had ceased to be.
If we may ask another Monty Python question. What was your most memorable Monty Python moment? And did you know that the movie The Holy Grail would have an instant cult following, particularly among college students?
No, we had no idea. And that's one of the things that I have learned, which you really never know whether something is going to work or not. Mm-hmm. And Steve Martin once said something to me which reflected my experience, but he's made many more films than I have. He said, when you start showing a film, a very strange thing happens. It seems as though the audience is beginning to like it more and more, or less and less. Isn't that weird? Very weird. So you don't know. And sometimes I write a line which I think is terribly, terribly funny. Like I say about my mother that she suffered from omniphobia. That was, you name it, she had a morbid dread of it.
Yeah.
And then I say, actually, it's not quite true. I never saw her frightened by a loaf of bread. You see, you get a little laugh.
Yeah, but not as much as you
no,
want.
No, but and then I wrote another line saying she lived to 101, her lifespan, the entire 20th century. Wow. And then I list from the assassination of the First World War, Hitler, Stalin, and all this. She lived through it all without really noticing any of it. When I wrote that, I thought it was amusing. That's the one that gets the laugh. So,
what has been your biggest disappointment? Because you also, in the creativity book, you talk about how it's not enough to have ideas. You have to test them. You have to put them out in the world to test them.
You know, my daughter once said to me that being a comedian is like being a bullfighter. And I said, what are you talking about? And she says, well, you get such immediate feedback on your performance.
But it's kind
and
of great.
Well, if you do that, you see, you can go out there, Nick, on Monday and do a joke you like, and the audience doesn't laugh, and you say, what a load of ignorant redneck. Mm-hmm. Then Tuesday they don't laugh, and you can still blame the audience. By Wednesday, you've decided it may not be as funny as you thought. So you're always checking it against the audience reaction, because if it doesn't make them laugh and it's intended to, you're getting something wrong with them.
A question here. How would critics and media respond to The Life of Brian if it was released today rather than 45 years ago, almost 45
years ago? I don't know. I really don't. I mean, it caused a big, big fuss at the time. When it opened in New York, we were condemned by the liberal Jews and one of the other three Jewish things. And then we were condemned by the Calvinists, the Catholics, the Lutherans. Altogether, seven churches.
Yeah. Who all hated each other.
Each other. They all told their followers, do not go to this film, the central message which is think for yourself. right, because Eric said, we've accomplished something very good. It's the first time in 500 years they've been able to agree on anything.
So, it is. I have to say... I was in high school. I went to a Catholic high school in New Jersey, and I took a bunch of my friends to go see Life of Brian. And it got back to the parents, it got back to my principal, and you owe me a rosary. I was told that if I wanted to stay in school, I had to say the rosary. So
really?
I have beef with you over that. I guess we're out of time, but can I ask a final question?
Yeah.
Is there any way to make politics funny?
You mean funnier?
Oh, fair enough. That's great. Thank you.
I think the great problem is this, that people... Oh, this is going to sound very profound. I'm going to like... people don't understand the difference between solemnity and seriousness. Now, we can have a perfectly serious chat like we've had now. We're taking things seriously and answering it the best of it, but it's not been solemn. So people think that anything with fun or humor is not serious. No, it's not solemn. You can always have a serious discussion with humor. And because people don't realize the difference, they think that anyone is, who's a little bit humorous is kind of lacks gravity. Do you see what I mean? And I think that's very sad. I once worked with a wonderful director called Jonathan Miller. And I was doing a Shakespeare with him. And somebody said to him, what do you feel about doing some of the, about doing a comedy, a Shakespeare comedy? And he said, well, comedy was good enough for Shakespeare and it was good enough for Mozart. So it's good enough for me. And I think that that's generally forgotten. People want, you know, some of the guys you have, you know, particularly to me in the, in the Republican Party, they have, they project ruggedness to the exclusion of everything else. You know, I mean, Mike Pence could have been carved out of wood, you know. You'd never have noticed the difference, you know, but he was serious and has gravity and... All right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much, John Cleese. Wonderful. Please, everyone.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. If you liked what you heard, please go right now to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. Or make it easy on yourself. Why not? It's a, you know, it's a hard day. It's been a long week. Make it easy on yourself. Just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there for this show. And while you're there, check out all of our shows. We've got three other great podcasts. That includes The Reason Roundtable, a weekly podcast with me, Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason, Peter Suderman, the features editor of Reason, and Matt Welch, who, like me, is an editor-at-large, hashing out the biggest issues of the day. It drops every Monday. It's a lot of fun. We also run the Soho Forum Debates, a recording of a live monthly Oxford-style debate over issues of particular interest to libertarians. And then we've got the newest entry in the Reason podcast stable, The Reason Rundown. It's a new weekly podcast in which Peter Suderman each week talks to a single Reason journalist about a single big story. It's great stuff, and it's all at reason.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.